From Port Allegheny to Waynesburg, St. Mary's to Everett, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Doug Mastriano will face off against Josh Shapiro to become the next governor of Pennsylvania. And the highly competitive race for the Republican U.S. Senate nomination headed for a recount. Leo Knepper from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania is here to analyze the primary election. Updated census numbers show the Pittsburgh region continues to lose population, a trend that is hindering economic growth. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report. And taxes are just one way the federal government costs us money. Excessive regulation also adds to the cost of goods and services. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania talks about it on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Leo Knepper from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. After setting a revenue record in the month of March, receipts at Pennsylvania casinos cooled a bit in April, but still generated more than $461 million in income. That is down about $1.1 million from the previous month. Revenue was about 14% higher than during the same month last year. The casinos paid $187.5 million in taxes to the state last month on their legal gambling operations. Brace yourself when you open your electric bill next month. The Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission warns that the rise in the price of natural gas used to generate electricity, coupled with the increased demand for electric during the summer months, will drive the increase. Depending upon which electric provider you use, generation costs will increase between 6 and 45%. West Penn Power customers will see the largest rate hike. If the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI, goes into full effect, residential electric bills are projected to increase by yet another 30%. Some of the regulatory waivers approved during the COVID-19 pandemic may become permanent as a way of jumpstarting innovation by placing fewer regulatory restrictions on businesses. State Representative David Rowe is co-sponsor of a measure to create so-called regulatory sandboxes, which he explains are a way to, quote, provide targeted regulatory relief from the needlessly cumbersome regulations for business, end quote. Rowe told the Center Square the approach was pioneered in Arizona and is under consideration in a number of states. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. State Senator Doug Mastriano scored a decisive win over 8 opponents in the race for the Republican gubernatorial nomination. But the party's U.S. Senate nomination remains undecided and likely headed for a recount, as Dr. Mehmet Oz and David McCormick are just a handful of votes apart. Here to sort through the election results is Leo Knepper. He is political director at the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania. Leo, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Leo, the marquee race nationally here in Pennsylvania was the Republican contest to be nominated to be United States Senator to succeed Pat Toomey, who is retiring. We really don't know who has won and may not know for a while, correct?
That's right. The way that the numbers are stacked up right now, it is close enough that it is going to automatically trigger a recount. So that process will play out over the course of several days. There may or may not also be legal challenges to the status of some of the ballots. So it can draw out a little bit just based on some of the legal things that are going to be happening.
So Dr. Mehmet Oz and Dave McCormick separated by just a couple of thousand votes. That number has been fluctuating greatly over the last few days. Of course, we do remind everybody that the numbers that we have in this and all races are unofficial tallies. The official count has only just begun, and we will await results of the official count. And then, Leo, I think you're correct. We're likely headed for a recount to see whether Dr. Oz or Mr. McCormick will be taking on John Fetterman. Fetterman really ran roughshod over Connor Lamb. What do you ascribe that to? Because initially we thought that might be somewhat of a close race.
Fetterman knows how to run an effective campaign. He ran a very effective lieutenant governor campaign and became the lieutenant governor nominee, probably much to the chagrin of Tom Wolf. That's what happened. He knows how to run a grassroots campaign. He has a fairly substantial amount of support. He had the funds necessary in order to run the campaign the way that it needed to be run. And it looks like he's probably going to end up with about 60% of the vote. So, I mean, that's pretty incredible.
It is. And does it say an awful lot here about the state of the Democrat Party? I mean, Fetterman is so far to the left, he actually makes Bernie Sanders look like Ted Cruz. He's so far to the left. This sort of an extreme left candidate, how do you see that playing in a general election against either one of the two possible Republican nominees? Are certainly going to be more moderate.
Fetterman really is going to have a problem within the race. He has a lot of positions that are very far left. He has some other positions that could couch under populism, perhaps, if you squint and tilt your head a little bit. So that might pick him up some support. But the types of people who are going to come out in a general election in Pennsylvania, I don't see them being the people who are going to vote for essentially far-left socialist policies in the fall. It just doesn't seem in keeping with Pennsylvania's, just for better or worse, had something more of a pragmatic streak. So that plus, what is the economy going to look like by November? Are we going to be still dealing with very high inflation? What are things going to look like? And how are the policies and policy prescriptions that Fetterman prefers, how are those going to impact the people who are paying the bills?
In the other major statewide race, that for governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, who also tends to the far left, the only Democrat candidate, so he's the nominee of that party now. In the Republican race, Shapiro and others are trying to paint the now Republican nominee, Doug Mastriano, as an extremist. But, Leo, talk a little bit about the positions that Senator Mastriano has taken, and are they really outside of the mainstream of thought here in Pennsylvania?
That's kind of a tough question to answer. I think that some of the positions that he has are going to be a little bit of a harder sell. Like when you take a look at some of his positions relative to social issues in particular, I also think that when you take a look at how he has approached the 2020 election and investigating the concerns that people have as to its legitimacy, I think that those are issues that can very easily be portrayed as to the extreme side of things in politics. On the other hand, the positions that he's taken, I mean, there are some very popular positions that he's taken. He was very much out in front in terms of ending the COVID lockdowns. He did some amazing work in really trying to hold the governor accountable for the things that the governor undertook throughout the pandemic. So I think in terms of those positions, in terms of how he views things like educational opportunity and how he views some other issues, I think he's very much in line with Pennsylvania. You know, most Pennsylvanians have seen the disastrous effects of the lockdowns. He was someone who was opposed to the school closings. I know that we had done work with him relative to the resolution and trying to get the emergency declaration ended very early on in the process, you know, when leadership in the Senate really didn't want to hear anything about trying to end the emergency declaration. You know, in some respects, he is very mainstream.
It's interesting. A lot is being made, Leo, about the fact that there was a crowded Republican field and it was divided, and that maybe if there had been a less crowded field, another candidate might emerge. However, taking a look now at the results, Doug Mastriano got just under 45% of the vote in a 9-candidate field. Two of those candidates had actually withdrawn, but their names were on the ballot. If you go back to 1994, the last time we had a large multi-candidate field, Tom Ridge was nominated with 34.5% of the vote. And in 1978, another large Republican field, Dick Thornburg was nominated with 32.6% of the vote. And here we have Mastriano with almost 45%. So is there really going to be any traction to the argument that he wouldn't be the nominee if we had a smaller field of candidates?
I think that there are going to be a lot of people who make that case very vocally. But you're right in pointing out just the number of candidates. If we were talking about this a 9-way race or a 7-way race, and he won with under 20% of the vote, you could make the argument that this was really just because of the size of the field. But when you take a look at the margin of victory that he had and just how financially stacked the deck was against him, the margin of his victory is incredibly impressive. And I don't think that lends itself to the was just a crowded field, because even if it was a 3-way race, if at 45% would probably be the winner.
Now, also on the ballot were seats for senator in the General Assembly, as well as all of the seats in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Very unusual this year, Leo. There have been far more incumbents who have gone down to defeat in the primary than normal. Most notably among them, the chairman of the State House Appropriations Committee was defeated. I know Cap was involved in that race. Tell us a little bit about it and what caused the defeat of Stan Saylor.
Really, what our Political Action Committee was able to do was accurately provide his constituents with what his record was. Representative Saylor, much like a lot of the other representatives who are in more solidly Republican districts, paint themselves out to be fiscally responsible, looking out for the taxpayers. You just kind of go down the litany of things that they say they're in favor of. But when they're in Harrisburg, they are not following through on what they're saying.
Very unusual, especially for a member of leadership to lose. And quickly here, Leo, also on the Senate side, another long-term state senator appears to have also lost to a cap-back challenger.
Yeah. The appropriations leader in the Senate, Senator Pat Brown, at this point has lost by 30 votes, which is just an incredibly tight margin. Jarrett Coleman, again, someone who got activated and became active politically because of what he saw during the pandemic and, you know, what he saw as a lack of responsiveness by his senator. What's really interesting is that when we take a look at the results of that race, Senator Brown actually lost his home county, Lehigh County, by a much more substantial margin. So the people who are closest to him liked him the least. The new part of this district where the people didn't know him, which reaches into Bucks County, preferred him, but they didn't actually know him. So he was able to make the case to people who weren't aware of his actual record that he was the best person for the job.
We have been talking with Leo Knepper, political director of the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania. Leo, a couple of words about the Citizens Alliance and where can folks go to find you online?
Their best option for finding us online is our website. The website is teamcap.org. The way that we approach things is that CAP believes that constituents, lawmakers should work for them. So, and that's at every level. We've launched what we're calling the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania Pledge, that we are going to be trying to get as many members of the General Assembly to sign as possible, lays out 11 items that are just kind of policy concerns. And what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to hold people accountable based on those 11 items that they are, you know, either pledging to support or pledging to oppose.
Leo Knepper from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania. Leo, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Loman.
Southwestern Pennsylvania population woes continue as the region continues to hemorrhage residents. For a look at the impact of the population loss and what must happen to reverse the trend, we turn to Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi for this Allegheny Institute report. Eric?
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Frank Gamrat, the executive director of the Institute. Frank, how are you today?
Well, Eric, I'm here, and that's more than I can say about the topic of our conversation today.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the topic that is very important to southwestern Pennsylvania. It's the subject of your recent brief, and that is population change. And Frank, you specifically wrote about the Pittsburgh MSA. Can you tell our listeners what counties comprise the MSA, and what has happened with population in the last 10 years?
Absolutely. For those who aren't familiar, the Pittsburgh Metropolitan Statistical Area consists of Allegheny County, Armstrong, Beaver, Butler, Fayette, Washington, and Westmoreland. So it's a 7-county region in southwestern Pennsylvania. And so we always look at the MSA data for jobs and employment. This got me thinking because one of the key measures that we like to look at is the labor force. And we just haven't had any growth in labor force. You know, we've seen this all around the region, and I'm sure the same thing around the state. People are trying to hire, and there's no one answering the call. And the question is, are they just not here? So I looked into the population changes. And in 2000, those seven counties had a combined population of 2.43 million people. By 2010, it actually had fallen 3.1% to 2.36 million people. Almost everybody had a drop in population with the exception of the two Washington and Butler counties. By 2020, the percent of the population grew, but just a half percent. It made its way to 2.37 million. But when you look at it compared to what it was 20 years ago, we're still almost 3% lower than we were 20 years ago. And again, Allegheny had a small increase, Butler, Washington had an increase, but the rest had decreases. So when you look at the fact that some population is either stagnating or falling, depending on how you want to look at it, because quite frankly, a 0.47% increase is really nothing. It's not even statistically significant. It could be a counting error at that stage. And it's no wonder that we're having a hard time finding people to fill jobs.
Give our listeners a look behind the census data, if you would. What are the factors that cause population change when they're totaling this up for a metro area?
There's really four main areas you look at. And of course, that is the natural method, and that's births versus deaths, those two components. And then you have migration. There's either international migration or domestic migration. In that first count, births minus deaths, counties around the MSA have just not done a very good job. Deaths have been outpacing births by a significant margin. From 2010 to 2020, we've had 42,000 more deaths than births. And so it's just, is it a factor of an aging population? Obviously. Now, I get that 2020 was the beginning of the pandemic and deaths were a little higher, but keep in mind that that was just a part of 2020. It wasn't all of 2020. And so the number of deaths were not abnormally greater than it otherwise had been for the previous 10 years. So you're looking at this subtraction just from natural movements of more people dying than being born. We're not significantly different than. Matter of fact, they were lower than what it had been on average the 10 years prior. So then that takes us to migration. Now, obviously, with international migration, people are coming in. And in the first 10 years, we had about 19,790 or so international migrants move into the seven county MSA. Picked up a little bit in the second 10 years from 2010 to 2020, it was 32,400. But a lot of them came in that 2013 to 2017 region, and then it tailed off significantly. And obviously, by 2020, it was very small, 1,400, and then a little less than 900 in 2021. So you can see where, obviously, with a pandemic, restricted international migration. So we're not getting a lot of folks coming in from other countries of the world. So then that brings us to the big one, domestic migration. People moving in and people moving out of the region who were born and raised in the area. And now this was a bit of a challenge. And the reason it was a challenge is because the Census Bureau publishes this data by the county. So when they say Allegheny County lost 6,700 people, the question is, well, where'd they go? They go to Washington County or Butler County, a neighboring county, or do they leave altogether, the state, the region, what have you? And so we looked at, in total, 2000 to 2009, all seven counties lost a total of 52,000 residents without migration. That's a big number. So again, not being able to really tell who just moved from one county to the other, what we do know is that the number of counties within migration is small. Butler and Washington, just a couple hundred, like 800-900, whereas Allegheny County lost 6,700 each year. It points to the fact that people weren't just moving within the MSA, that they were, in fact, moving outside the MSA altogether. Now, you take 2010-2020, the next 10 years, and the domestic out-migration slowed a little bit to 35,600. And I think a large part of that is, you know, keep in mind what went on in that time frame in the early 2010s through 2015-16, we had our Marcellus shale boom. And we did have a lot of people coming into the region from Texas, Oklahoma, et cetera. So we did have a bit of an increase in folks moving into the area at that point in time because of the Marcellus shale boom. And it was enough to stem a little bit of that decline, but not much. Now, of course, this begs the question, if you had a little bit of growth between 2000 and 10 in 2020, yet you had all this net out migration domestically, yet just not enough in migration. Where did it come from? And I always caution people that when you look at things like deaths, births, international and domestic migration numbers, they are estimates. They're annual estimates that are done by the Census Bureau. It's not like they're standing at the border counting U-Hauls going out or standing in the hospital waiting by the maternity wards to count heads on in swaddles. So you certainly have to keep in mind that these are, in fact, estimates, but it is proving the point that there's just not much in the way of population growth taking place in this part of the state.
Well, that brings us to our last question. What can we do to improve population growth?
We looked at the other MSAs. Now, we do, for our readers, recall a benchmark city. Our benchmark city is comprised of Charlotte, Columbus, Omaha, and Salt Lake. Well, I looked at those MSAs to kind of get a comparison. And, of course, the nation as a whole. The nation as a whole grew 17%, while we grew only 0.5%. So we didn't keep very good pace with the nation. But just from 2010 to 2020, Charlotte, North Carolina, which is a 7-county MSA, not including South Carolina counties, there's three of those, they grew 18%. Columbus, Ohio grew 12.6%. Omaha, Nebraska counties only, grew 14%, and Salt Lake City with its two counties grew almost 16%. So we just are not keeping pace with other MSAs. In fact, the Charlotte and Columbus MSA, Charlotte came in at 2.23 million in 2020. Columbus came in at 2.14 million. We're at 2.37. They're right on our heels. My guess is within the next census in 2030, those two cities, those two MSAs will have passed us. We're just not growing. So getting back to your original question of what do? We look to the climate. You know, why do people move to an area? We saw this in the 19th and early 20th centuries here in Western Pennsylvania. That's jobs. People will go where there are jobs and opportunity, and you need an economic climate that's conducive to do so. And so with our high taxes and our regulations and our fealty to unions, we just do not have the economic or the business climate in Pennsylvania that is drawing people in. Keep in mind, this does not cover Pennsylvania as a whole, but we just did lose a congressional seat. So that tells me that Pennsylvania as a whole is losing. We're just not growing as a state, and until we make drastic changes, it's just not going to reverse itself.
Great stuff as always. We encourage our listeners to visit our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, to read this brief and other work. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Overregulation adds to the true cost to the federal government. On this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania explains how.
We last discussed Americans for Prosperity's national True Cost of Washington campaign, designed to educate Americans across 9 states about the truth behind rising costs while offering real solutions to make everyday life more affordable. Since the campaign's launch at the top of the month, we've had tens of thousands of Americans engage their members of Congress with the policies they could advance that would immediately impact Americans' lives for the better. We've discussed the first two tenets of the campaign, the need to unleash energy abundance and the need to end wasteful spending. And today we'll discuss the third set of policies that could instantaneously mitigate the high cost and scarcity of goods, cutting red tape that keeps prices high. In implementing President Trump's executive order on accelerating the nation's economic recovery from the COVID-19 emergency by expediting infrastructure investments and other activities, federal agencies are tasked with reviewing all statutes, regulations, and guidance documents that may provide for emergency or expedited treatment, including waivers, exemptions, and other streamlining with regard to agency actions pertinent to infrastructure, energy, environmental, or natural resources matters, reporting to the White House and using such statutes and regulations to the fullest extent permitted to facilitate the nation's economic recovery. Along with Executive Order 13924 on regulatory relief to support economic recovery, This order illustrates how, in the same way we removed barriers that inhibited pandemic response by healthcare professionals, businesses, workers, government employees, and innovators, we can remove barriers that can unnecessarily inhibit a stronger economic recovery as our country starts to reopen for business. These rules are so often outdated and overly burdensome, with a disproportionate burden for small business owners and regressive impacts on the most vulnerable Americans. Decades of regulatory accumulation, with unnecessary or duplicative rules and requirements piling one on top of the other without any meaningful review of their impact or efficacy, can undermine economic growth and result in unintended consequences. And beneath that weight, our regulatory system is not often sufficiently nimble enough to anticipate or respond to crises. To their credit, federal agencies have rescinded, suspended, and fast-tracked hundreds of rules to fight the disease, as well as provide flexibility to American businesses, workers, and innovators to deliver essential goods and services. These orders constitute a starting gun for these agencies to redouble these efforts and think more broadly about removing barriers to a stronger economic recovery. Grocery prices rose 8.6% just last month. And this is due to so many factors, including inflation, driven by excessive government spending and supply chain issues. But it's also caused by regulations that restrict access to the everyday goods you rely on to keep your household running. One of those regulations is the Renewable Fuel Standard. This law requires gas and other transportation fuels to contain a certain amount of biofuel, such as ethanol. 40% of all corn produced in the U.S. is used to make ethanol. Under RFS, corn prices have increased dramatically, incentivizing farmers to replace other crops with corn and grow corn wherever they can. This in turn raises prices of other foods, which are now scarcer because they're being cultivated less. Please visit truecostofwashington.com and email your member now and let them know that removing antiquated regulations, creating energy abundance, and stopping out-of-control spending must be their priority. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity. Find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 27 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WEXC-FM and WGRP-AM in Greenville, along with WTKT-AM in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.